Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit nonpartisan organization. I'm Beth Binchik, Director of Policy and Program at ACS. In what many called a hot labor summer, we saw high-profile strikes and renewed energy in the labor movement. This energy continued beyond the summer, with the United Auto Workers engaging in a stand-up strike in the fall, and the Screen Actors Guild ratifying their agreement just earlier this month. Here to help us understand this season in the labor movement is Catherine Fisk, Professor of Law at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Catherine's recent works have addressed the intersection of labor, antitrust, and copyright law in structuring labor relations in American theater, the crafting of New Deal-era labor and social welfare legislation, social movement lawyering, and more. Her scholarship has been published in leading publications, including the California Law Review, Berkeley Journal of Employment and Labor Law, Harvard Law Review Forum, and Yale Law Journal Forum, among others. Catherine, welcome to Broken Law.
Pleasure to be here.
This has been not only a summer, but a year of increased labor activity. What do you think is fueling this energy?
One thing that's fueling the upsurge in labor activism is the dramatic increase in inequality in the United States. The rich have gotten phenomenally richer, and the middle class and the poor are being left further behind. So today, as in the 1930s, the last really major labor upsurge that was quite transformative that we had, people are angry. But in addition, the labor activity is a product of visionary new leadership in many unions, new strategies for how to mobilize the collective power of workers, and a somewhat favorable legal climate that makes it a little bit less risky for workers to speak up and speak out than it has been in previous governmental periods.
So I'd like to start off by talking specifically about the Hollywood strikes. The Writers Guild strike lasted 148 days with members ratifying their contract in October. SAG-AFTRA's members were on strike for 118 days and ratified their contract just earlier this December. When considering what led the unions to strike, the emergence of new technology seems to have played a large role. In particular, the traditional compensation model for writers and performers didn't account for streaming services. Could you explain how writers and performers have traditionally been compensated for their work?
Sure. But before I get to that, I want to point out that the 2023 Hollywood strike was the first time since 1960 that writers and actors together had gone on strike. And that meant they had more leverage than either of them would have standing alone. And I think that was important to the success of both of them. Both writers and actors, and for that matter, directors, get compensated in part based on just their labor time. They get paid by the week or by the day or by the job. But in addition, starting in the late 1940s, directors, writers and actors negotiated to get paid by a measure of the success of their work in a system called residuals. Residuals are a little bit like copyright royalties in the sense that it's payment for reuse of work. But they're not copyright royalties. They're different in significant ways. And to understand why, it helps to understand the origin of the residual system. When the writers, directors, and actors sat down with the movie studios to negotiate their second ever collective bargaining agreement in the late 40s, they negotiated that they would own the copyrights in their work. Playwrights for the stage do own the copyrights in their plays, and they license them to theater producers. But writers, actors, and directors, all of whom might be authors under copyright law, early on agreed that the studios would be the owners of the copyrights in their work. The studios absolutely insisted on this because the contributions to a movie involve lots of different copyrightable materials written by lots of different creators or authors. But nevertheless, the writers in particular, led by a group of extremely successful Academy Award-winning writers who also happened to be extremely astute and radical leftists, decided that it was time to negotiate for ownership of their work and for a kind of a profit-sharing arrangement. The studios responded, as all of American business responded to the labor upsurge in 1947, with the most vicious period of attack on leftists that we had seen in decades, accusing them, in some cases correctly, in most cases incorrectly, of being communists, and drumming them out of Hollywood in a period known generally to the country as the red baiting era or McCarthyism, but known in Hollywood as the blacklist era, where it became impossible to work in Hollywood if you were accused of being a communist. It didn't stop the studios actually from hiring writers who were blacklisted. They just wrote through what were known as fronts. Because of this attack on labor, the writers ultimately lost their effort to own the copyrights in their works and to get paid for reuse of it, and instead settled for this system of residuals. It developed over time between the late 1940s and 1960, where writers, actors, and directors agreed that they would get paid a residual for each time their work was reused, like a movie shown on television or a TV show being rerun. All of that made sense and worked pretty well in the era of broadcast, where lots and lots of television shows and movies were rerun on TV all the time. And it enabled the system to work pretty well because work in Hollywood has always been episodic, and it's become even more episodic, meaning writers, actors, and directors work for a period of time, and then they have long periods of unemployment where they're working. They're trying to develop their next project. They're writing a screenplay. They're working on their craft. They're in negotiation for their next big project. But for writers in particular, these long periods of unemployment can be economically catastrophic. You count on getting paid enough while you're working and saving, and also getting this steady stream of residual payments to fund your period of unemployment and your development of your next project so that you can survive and stay in the industry. And for a project I did about 7 or 8 years ago, I interviewed about 36 successful writers, some still working as writers, some working as producers, about the significance of residuals and other aspects of their creative life and their working conditions. And all of them said that it's essential to figure out a way to compensate writers for their downtime between projects to keep their human capital in the industry. It's simply not a feasible model if you want to create really high-quality television to constantly cycle through a bunch of very low-paid recent college graduates who are so happy to be working in Hollywood. They'll sleep on somebody's couch and work for not a lot of money in the hopes of making it big. There are countries whose television model works that way, and their TV is nowhere near the high quality that ours is, because they don't know how to write a good episode of television and how to do it on time and on budget. For example, one writer told me that unless you really know what you're doing, you don't realize that you shouldn't write an episode of a thriller where the main character gets shot on a boat and falls into the water, because to do that is very expensive. You have to hire a stunt double, because you're not going to put the main celebrity actor falling off a boat into the water all the time. It's too dangerous. Plus, you only get one shot to do it, because once they've fallen in the water, they're wet. Everybody who's working on the episode is going to be standing around waiting while they're fished out of the water, dried off, makeup done, hair done, and then you shoot the scene over again. So the human capital really matters, and residuals are necessary to make that whole system work. Now, what has happened to residuals? The decline of reruns, and in particular, the decline of reruns on broadcast television, where it was really obvious when something was being reused, as opposed to when it was in its first use. Because, of course, in the world of streaming, some people will stream the episode the day it drops or the week that the whole series drops, but many people will come to it a week later, 2 weeks later, a month later. And so when streaming first developed, the studios insisted on a very long period to count as its original run. 6 months, a year. I mean, they didn't want ever to pay residuals for reruns again because they saw this as dramatic cost savings. And in the 2007-2008 strike, the writers agreed after a long period of unrest to a formula for residuals for streaming video on demand that was less generous than, to writers at least, than was the system of residuals for broadcast. Now that broadcast is nearly gone, and even the legacy networks like NBC, CBS, and ABC have streaming services, the writers had to go back and negotiate again for a new formula.
How do the Writers Guild and Screen Actors Guild agreements that were reached this year address streaming services and change that compensation model?
It's phenomenally complicated.
That's an understatement.
There are only a small number of people who really understand the nitty-gritty details. But the basic idea is that through this strike, writers succeeded and then actors followed on to change the formula to allow for payment of residuals in greater amounts and starting earlier in the period where something is streaming. And in addition, they got what they had never gotten before, and this really matters, for example, for Netflix. They got Netflix to agree that it would allow a third party, not the guild, which is the Writers Guild, which is the way it's always been done, but rather a third party to look at the data on streaming and who's watching which shows for how long and how many people are watching to calculate the success of any particular episode of any particular show so that writers can share in the wealth that Netflix or any of the other streaming services gets from having an extremely popular show. Netflix, of course, knows all of this. They know down to the tiniest little detail of which episode you watch, where you pause it, whether you come back to it, how soon you come back to it, which episodes you watch more than once. And they, of course, have this information that they use in making business decisions, and they have guarded it extremely jealously. But there's no way to compensate writers for their success, for the popularity of the show, which, of course, is what residuals are all about, without somebody looking at Netflix's data and figuring out how to calculate residuals. And of course, whoever is looking at that has to keep the information not only confidential to Netflix, but who does Netflix really care about knowing it? Not the writers. They really care about their competitors knowing it. But of course, because all of the companies are parties to the same collective bargaining agreement, the system has to be fair. And this is familiar to the legacy media companies, the network television stations, the movie studios like 20th Century Fox, Sony, Universal, et cetera. But for Netflix and Amazon, which are relatively new to this business, and for Amazon in particular, where their entertainment business is a tiny slice of their global business, they have to be educated about why sharing some of this information with a third party for the sake of compensating their unionized labor is a good idea. And one of the things that made this strike so long and so difficult is that the Writers Guild and the actors have a long history of negotiating with the Hollywood media companies and relatively stable, you know, they expect that they're going to negotiate one contract after another because they've been doing it for almost 90 years. Amazon is not unionized in the other parts of its industry. They only agreed to unionization for Hollywood because they wanted access to the best directing, writing, and acting talent. And of course, because of the power of the guilds and the solidarity of the workers, they will not work on non-union productions, period, full stop. Because if they do, they know they are going to undermine their own conditions in the short term and the long term. So the non-traditional Hollywood companies have to get used to the way things work in screen entertainment.
So as you described it, the data sharing that is included in these contracts has some limitations. Do you think this will open up the door to future negotiations and maybe, you know, increase data transparency in the future?
Whether it increases data transparency in the future between the companies, I don't know. They'll do that if they think they have business reasons to do it. But what it has done is created a model that could be used outside of Hollywood to compensate creative labor in proportion to the financial success the companies enjoy because of their work. And so that could matter, for example, in interactive media like video games, where if the workers figured out a way to negotiate collectively, they could use Hollywood as a model for figuring out how to compensate all of the creative talent, not only through the salary or through the project payment if they're paid by the job, but also as products are resold and reused over time. And that could be quite transformative, for example, in interactive media, video games. And that might happen, of course, because Hollywood writers and Hollywood actors are working in interactive media production because the storytelling is becoming more narrative, more serialized the way that it has long been in film and television. And of course, some of the same literary properties are being sold for development in both media. Think of the Harry Potter video games. So I think the system used to enable the information to be provided to the representative of workers could be a model in lots of other industries.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
Artificial intelligence was also a prominent topic of negotiation. What concerns did the writers and the performers have relating to artificial intelligence?
AI is so new and has been developing so rapidly that the use of AI to substitute, especially for writing, is something that took both, I think, the companies and the writers a little bit by surprise. Collective bargaining in Hollywood, because it happens intermittently, you know, every several years and has been going on for 90 years, is a big process where each side anticipates what their priorities are going to be in the upcoming round of negotiations. And each side kind of knows what they are worried about and what their constituents want. You know, is it going to be about pensions? Is it going to be about health insurance? That wasn't really an issue in, or a big issue in this round of negotiations. They were worried about compensation for streaming media and some other things that we could talk about. But then suddenly, the use of AI and large language models to generate written content became a significant threat, especially, I think, for formulaic television, right? Really radically new and creative shows. AI can't do that yet. It can only imitate and sort of compile what's out there. What it can't do is come up with something that nobody's thought of before. But lots of production companies and lots of writers make their bread and butter money, and writers get trained by writing the 20th season of some crime drama. And so the fear was that some production company would say, ChatGPT, write me an episode of Law and Order or CSI or whatever. And that would take away work opportunities from writers to get trained on how to write a police procedural or a crime drama or a thriller, and also just reduce the total amount of employment. And so the sacrifice of training and the sacrifice of jobs could be a big threat. And over on the actor's side, the advance of CGI has made it possible to think about, instead of hiring extras to fill in a crowd scene, just generating a bunch of fake people. Or the ability to use CGI for a star, which we know has happened. Think about the Star Wars movies that could bring back Carrie Fisher for a scene after she had died. That's not just a way to bring back a famous actor in a franchise like Star Wars, but it could be a way to use the name, image, and likeness of an actor going forward. And of course, big dollar actors with agents would never agree to a contract that allowed the studio to do that. But aspiring young actors who are desperate to get into the business might indeed agree to that as a condition of getting their first role. And then if they become a huge celebrity based on that one performance, then the studio basically owns them going forward, which could prevent them from earning money for their second, third, or fourth movie. And so this became something that both the actors and the writers realized could be a do or die issue, not at this moment, but in 3 years or 5 years at the rate at which the technology is improving. And so both sides, both the studios and the actors and the Writers Guild, realized this was an issue they had to confront. And both the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA, the actors' union, won big on that issue. And indeed, the writers and the actors just generally, I should say, won very significant wins through their strikes as compared to what the studios originally offered.
Yeah, tell us more about what the writers and the performers won with respect to artificial intelligence, what the contracts have in there.
Basically, what they won is that AI cannot be used to substitute for writers or actors, except under very limited circumstances. So for the, I mean, it's complicated.
Yes, it is.
Everything is complicated in Hollywood contracts. But at least for now, they are protected from the worst threats.
Yeah, I think in the writer's agreement, you know, one of the ways they did this is defining a writer as human, which, you know, seems almost revolutionary now with AI and its possibilities.
Right. Yes. Writers have to be humans under the definition of who's a writer in the Writers Guild agreement. That's true for copyright law, too. I mean, the studios weren't proposing or had to be careful about proposing to entirely substitute AI creation, because then the scripts themselves would not be copyrightable, which means anybody else could take the original script. The film would be copyrightable, but not the script that was a component of it. But of course, Congress or courts can change copyright law. The writers wanted to control what they can control, which is what they do through their contracts. But it's worth noting that the contract, the WGA AMPTP contract, does not prevent studios from training AI models on existing material that they have. And so we can expect over time that these large language models are going to get better and better at writing a first draft of something. But that's not necessarily all bad. Writers themselves might want to use AI to write a first draft. And so I think what's really important about having a union and having powerful negotiations is that each side could recognize that their constituents could benefit from a new technology. Each side recognizes that their constituents could be harmed by a new technology. And by negotiating collectively, especially when both sides are negotiating from a position of power, it prevents one side from reaping all the financial gains from new technology and inflicting all of the risk and all of the loss on the other side.
Yeah, and that really seems to be so much of what the Hollywood strikes were about, was focusing on how these new technologies could have huge benefits and who should share in those benefits, not, you know, exacerbating the income inequality that we started off talking about, but really making sure that workers get a share of that as well.
Right. And both the Writers Guild and the actors unions have always been good about recognizing that some writers or actors achieve a level of success where they don't actually really need the union. They have their agent, they get paid a lot of money, and they're fine. But the union really exists for the benefit of the vast majority who don't have that kind of individual leverage. And the leading writers, many of whom are leaders in the Writers Guild, and actors, you know, there were celebrity actors out on the picket line. Why were they there? They were there because they recognized that they came up through a system that protected them when they didn't have the labor market power to protect themselves. And they're willing to give up perhaps some of the money that they would get and certainly some of the autonomy they would have by negotiating individually for the benefit of the whole ecosystem that protects the up-and-comers and that produces amazing content in new and innovative ways over the decades. This has always been true of those unions, I mean, to greater and lesser extent, but that's what has made Hollywood interesting among labor regimes, is that you have extremely highly paid workers in the same union with workers who are waiting tables and making coffee drinks while they sort of are trying to get a break in the industry and trying to come up with a system that works for the benefit of everybody.
The Hollywood strikes and the successes that they achieved appear to have created some energy around organizing reality TV performers. Could you tell us more about that effort?
Yes. The Writers Guild has been trying to organize reality TV producers, who are the people who write the so-called reality settings. And the Actors Guild has been trying to organize reality TV performers for quite a while. And reality TV performers could be writers because many of them create the settings in consultation with the producers that they then act in. And it's been a struggle because they simply don't have the long history and they work differently than television writers who sit in a room and actually write written things, and the writing is done more collaboratively with the producer who's working for the production company. And of course, reality performers have to be even more entrepreneurial than writers, traditional writers do, because they're monetizing themselves in every possible way they can. And so the organizing is challenging. During the 2007-2008 writer's strike, the last writer's strike, the companies, the production companies, started substituting reality TV for scripted programming in order to provide content during the strike. And so at that time, they thought of reality TV as a substitute for writers' labor. They were sort of the strike breakers of the strike. Although because they weren't doing the same kind of work, it wasn't exactly like strike breaking. And so the Writers Guild, of course, recognizes that they would be in a much stronger position. And by the way, working conditions in reality TV would be much better if they were unionized as well. Those who produce reality TV, the companies, of course, would love to keep it a non-union, relatively lower paid, less protected labor force. And so this is an ongoing struggle. But I think the significant thing about the writers and the actors both winning big in this strike is that it sends a message to people working in writing adjacent industries like reality TV or video game production, that they face common problems and they could achieve success if they unionize. What'll happen? Hard to know.
Shifting gears, I'd like to talk about another big strike that occurred, the United Auto Workers strike against the Big Three. The UAW ratified what are being called historic contracts with Ford, GM, and Stellantis after a six-week stand-up strike. Could you tell us how those contracts will affect workers and their compensation and benefits?
The UAW strike this year was the first time in the history of the auto industry that unionized workers of all three of the big three U.S. automakers struck simultaneously. Historically, the way the UAW negotiated with the big three was that they would pick one of the three to be the first company they would negotiate with. And that meant that that was the company that was going to face a strike if the negotiations reached an impasse. And then when they got the contract with the first of the big three, then the other two would simply follow the pattern. And it was called pattern bargaining. So unlike in Hollywood, where all the companies negotiate together on a multi-employer basis, in autos, each company negotiates individually, but they are patterns for each other. It's called pattern bargaining. But this year, new and visionary leadership of the UAW, and it's important to note that a union is only as strong as its members and as the leaders of the union are able to inspire the members. And so Sean Fain and other new leadership at the UAW decided to break with tradition, negotiate with all three companies at the same time, but not to strike the entirety of any one of the company's operations at the same time, and instead to strike, if they had to strike, only at particular factories. And they chose those factories very wisely and strategically for maximum rider leverage. In other words, choosing factories to strike that were the most significant to the company's profits or the most significant to high demand models of various vehicles. Why did they call it a stand-up strike? It was because all strikes are stand-up strikes. That is, the workers leave the workplace and go stand in the street with a sign on a stick, urging other workers not to go in and take their jobs, and urging increasingly today, but really always, consumers to stand in solidarity with them by not buying the product or by pressuring the company to pay the workers better. But why the UAW called this a stand-up strike was an homage to or an acknowledgement of how Detroit unionized in the first place, which is workers engaged in sit-down strikes. That is, they occupied the plant. Why did workers have to occupy GM plants in the bitter winter of 1936-1937? Because the company was virulently anti-union. And refused, they said, forever, always, and at any cost to recognize the right of workers to bargain collectively, and violently suppressed strikes when they happened. And so workers recognized that the only way they could safely strike, since companies thought nothing of calling out the police, armed militias that were employed by the company, not even by the government, using tear gas, machine guns. I mean, labor disputes were violent in a way that we cannot imagine today. At various points in history, companies purchased more munitions to use on their workforce than the U.S. Department of Defense and Armed Services purchased to use on American enemies. So sit-down strikes were safer for workers because companies would not blow up their own factory to win a strike, where they would use tear gas, machine guns, and other violent methods to win a strike if the workers were standing on the sidewalk. The sit-down strikes succeeded in getting unionization and decent wages for workers in automobile plants for the first time in history. And so the UAW this year was saying, we're going to do a stand-up strike. Like the sit-down strikes in the days of old, we'll focus on one particular facility, and we're going to choose it without advance notice, because we think that's how we can persuade you to agree to reasonable contract terms. And it worked. So what did the UAW get from the strike? they got back to where they were prior to the auto companies demanding huge concessions from labor in the downturn in the auto industry 10 years ago or more. In the economic downturn of 2008, 9, 10, 11, remember the one where the government had to bail out the auto companies because they were too big to fail? The workers helped keep those companies afloat by taking huge pay cuts and by agreeing to a pay scale that paid new workers less, dramatically less, than senior workers were doing for the same work on the same assembly line in the same factory. These two-tier pay scales companies love because it just lowers their labor costs while keeping experienced workers on the job who they can then use to train junior workers. High turnover is a problem in relatively skilled labor. In fact, high turnover is a problem in any workforce because the companies may not have enough workers to do the work. It slows down production. And also, they spend a lot of money recruiting workers and giving them even a brief amount of training as necessary to do even relatively unskilled job. So worker know-how really matters, and companies want to keep the senior workers. Can't do that if you're cutting their pay, but you can do it to a new worker. And so one of the things that the UAW wanted to eliminate, or at least dramatically reduce, was these two-tier pay scales, because those breed enmity among workers. The junior worker looks at the senior person who's standing right next to them 8 hours a day on the assembly line and says, wait, why are you getting paid two times what I'm getting paid for the same work? It's hard to have solidarity if you feel resentful. And so it was important to the UAW, now that the companies are making enormous profits, to win back the pay cuts that they agreed to help keep the companies afloat when the companies were losing money, and also to get more equal pay for workers doing the same work.
So I think in the UAW contracts, there were wage increases across the board. But as you discussed, there was a focus on those lower paid workers and trying to help equalize pay across the workforce. Can you explain just how that affects, you know, future bargaining power?
It affects future bargaining power by building solidarity so that workers all see themselves as peers, or where differences in compensation are explainable by a fair metric like skill or seniority rather than something that's prone to discrimination or arbitrary decision making. That builds solidarity going forward. And of course, raising the pay for the lowest paid workers is significant. First of all, it's an anti-poverty tool. But secondly, it builds loyalty of the workers both to the company. Auto jobs could be good jobs again, which keeps people in the industry, which is good for the companies because you get the know-how and the loyalty. But it's also good for the union. Workers recognize that if you work union, you get paid better. And so that means they will have the solidarity that it takes to negotiate for a good contract the next time around as well. And of course, unionization also brings non-monetary benefits, like the requirement that the company have just cause for firing. And that means that just because your supervisor doesn't like you, for whatever reason, you're protected against being assigned to work a bad shift or being fired totally or being harassed on the job, because the contract with the enforcement mechanism that the union does for its members, those are workers doing it for each other, provides protection against arbitrary or discriminatory or abusive treatment, you don't have to find a lawyer and file a lawsuit. And that's a win for the workers, by the way, also a win for the company. But in addition, the increased pay and increased benefits that the UAW won will be very significant in organizing non-union auto plants. There are a lot of non-union auto companies making cars in the U.S. And many of these companies, especially Volkswagen, for example, and the other European automakers that have operations in the U.S., are unionized in their non-U.S. manufacturing facilities. So, for example, VW in Tennessee is not unionized, but VW in Germany is. Several years ago, the UAW tried to organize the VW plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. UAW used the leverage of the VW union in Germany, and indeed, the VW management at the time was not particularly opposed to unionization. They're used to working with a union. It works perfectly well in Germany and elsewhere. The opposition to unionization really came from Republican elected officials in Tennessee who saw unionization as a risk, not to the workers at the VW plant, but to Republican Party power in Tennessee, because one of the Republican Party's most reliable positions is to be vehemently anti-union. And so the organizing campaign at VW failed in Chattanooga, but now that workers at the big three automakers won such a big win, the non-union automakers have a choice. They can either recognize that they may face renewed organizing efforts in their operations, or they can raise wages and improve working conditions in their operations to head off unionization. Either way, what the UAW won is a win for anybody working in the auto industry, because some of the non-union companies have already announced pay increases so that their pay is not so dramatically out of line with what is paid at other parts of the U.S. auto industry. In addition, one of the things that the UAW won in its negotiations against the big three automakers was the ability to more effectively organize those companies' non-union electric vehicle manufacturing operations. The companies have created or expanded battery manufacturing and other electric vehicle component manufacturing primarily in the South. Why the South? Because Southern states tend to be non-union. They have laws making it much harder to organize a union and to maintain a union once you've organized one. And so the companies, for reasons of the lower wage scales, located their electric vehicle manufacturing facilities in the South. And the UAW has not been shy to say one of the things they are going to focus on is organizing electric vehicle facilities. And of course, that's in everybody's interest. The U.S. government is supporting green infrastructure, including expansion of electric vehicles to replace the gas-powered vehicles that are warming the atmosphere. And so if the U.S. government is subsidizing green jobs, the UAW would like to make sure that those green jobs are also good jobs with good pay, good health care, good pensions, and fair job conditions, all of which is brought to you by the United Auto Workers. At least that's the way they think of it.
So, Catherine, there's just been so much happening with labor over the past year. Do you think the labor movement can sustain this momentum? And if so, how?
You know, the problem with crystal balls is they're prone to being wrong or to breaking. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. I think the winds in Hollywood and in the auto industry are really significant. I think the attitude of the public to unionization is really significant. Public opinion polls show that support for unions is higher today than it's been since the 1960s, and it's nearing an all-time historic high, with a little less than 3/4 of people having favorable activities to unions. So that's a win. And support for unions is especially high among younger workers, or younger people generally, not just students who tend to be politically left generally, but others. So that all points to continued success of union campaigns. And there are union campaigns going on all over the place. But companies have become very, very sophisticated in their opposition to unions. So I think last time I checked, about 300 Starbucks outlets had unionized, and not a single one of them has yet to get a union contract because the Starbucks leadership, the corporate leadership, is so militantly anti-union. They would rather pay their lawyers to fight unionization in the National Labor Relations Board, in the courts, than to pay their workers what a union wage and union working conditions would look like, because the leadership just thinks that unionization is going to be bad for the company. Same is true at Amazon, although the Amazon labor union has had less success in organizing, in part because the facilities are so much larger and so many Amazon workers work either in giant facilities where the company can effectively fight a union campaign, or else they work in a very solitary place like driving a delivery truck, assuming they're even employed by Amazon at all, where it's much harder to unionize. Similarly, Uber and Lyft have made defeating job protections for their workers and unionization their number one priority, because the cheap price of an Uber, every time you get in an Uber and you say, wow, that's all it costs. First of all, it's a lot more than it was when Uber faced a meaningful legal threat to its low-wage model. But secondly, it remains relatively low, and they want to keep it that way. And so whether the labor organizing and favorable public attitudes towards labor produce wins will depend a certain amount on what happens more generally in our political and legal climate. The U.S. Supreme Court is militantly anti-union. In fact, they're pretty militantly anti-labor, period. The last time they had a labor case that they decided for the labor union side was maybe 20 years ago. And so, you have to go back way longer than that to find a reliable record of union wins in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a deeply conservative institution traditionally, and now it is more conservative than it's been in 100 years, and that's not going to change. And so I think it may depend on who wins the election in 2024 at the federal level. And of course, so much depends on that. It's really hard to know. Labor is just one part of that.
So for those listeners that are interested in labor and workers' rights and want to take the next step, where can they go to learn more about these issues?
Lots of unions have great websites. If workers are concerned with a particular sector or what the particular union is doing for the workers it represents. There's also a lot of great writing out there in various kinds explaining why unions matter and what they do. So for those listeners who primarily get their information from podcasts or from TikTok, I recommend actual traditional print journalism like The American Prospect covers labor issues really well. The Nation covers labor issues quite well. And if you want to understand the business case for it, historically, the Wall Street Journal has actually covered labor issues fairly well, because, of course, labor is such a huge part of any company's business model that business leaders read about labor in the Wall Street Journal because they want to know what they as business leaders should think about labor. And so that reports it from a more business side, the New York Times, of course, reporting it from a more neutral or a more left side. There are any number of wonderful histories of the labor movement or sociological analyses of it. But I think that in many cases, the best way to do it is actually to hear what unions say about what they do, because they are by and for the workers. And it's the worker voice speaking out on what matters to workers.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. It was a pleasure having you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for finding Broken Law. You can find our past episodes wherever you're listening to this one. If you're enjoying Broken Law, help us bring the show to more listeners by recommending it to a friend and leaving us a review. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.